Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for May 13th, 2024. Here's today's rundown. Recent healthcare whistleblower cases are approaching nearly $10 million. Could there be more? Famed whistleblower attorney Mary Inman reports. We will also hear from Philana Houston, healthcare attorneys Nicole Emanuel and David Glazer, plus Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Mondays. We've come on the air this morning. We're monitoring a story from Colorado. Panoramic Health faces a wrongful termination suit filed Thursday in the Colorado federal court by its former assistant general counsel. She claims she was fired after raising concerns about an alleged kickback statutes and regulations over its federally funded kidney care contracting program. We'll have more whistleblower news report later in this broadcast when Mary Inman joins us. In the meantime, we have healthcare news reports, so we begin this morning, as we usually do, with Dr. Ronald Hirsch. He's making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Monday Rounds is sponsored by R1 Physician Advisory Solutions. Here now making his Monday rounds is Dr. Ronald Hirsch.
Well, good morning, all. Today is another cornucopia of topics. First, last week's issue of Report on Medicare Compliance by Nina Youngstrom had a very interesting article which may be pertinent for physician advisors. She discussed a hospital that discovered they were paying physician medical directors for hours where the physician was not actually providing administrative duties. If that physician is still practicing clinically, that payment could be considered a Stark Law violation. Now, I've heard that some hospitals use medical directorships as a way to reward physicians for their loyalty and volume, and that's fine as long as there's actual work performed. Now, of course, it would be the hospital that gets in trouble and not the physician. But if you're a physician advisor who's not full-time, be sure you're tracking your time and specifying what work you're doing during that time. Moving on, Dr. John Zellum recently alerted me about a new injustice. He had been made aware of one prominent national payer that is only paying for admissions to critical access hospitals for 4 days of care, even if the stay exceeds that time frame and the care was all necessary. They claim that since critical access hospital inpatients are only supposed to be expected to stay under 96 hours, that's all they should pay. Of course, that logic is senseless, but that seldom stops a payer from making such rules. Interestingly, during COVID, this payer stopped this because CMS waived the 96-hour rule, but now they're recouping for admissions that happened after the end of the public health emergency. It's really just amazing what crazy policies these payers are able to create out of thin air to preserve their multi-billion dollar corporate profits. Now, if you're a critical access hospital, you have one in your system, check your claims and make sure that payers are not making unexpected adjustments or recoupments in situations like this. Finally, someone asked me about transfer patients and the admission order. Their hospital accepted a patient in transfer who spent 2 days as an inpatient at the first facility, but the inpatient order at their hospital was not entered in the medical record until the day after the patient arrived, and the patient stayed a total of 3 days. The case manager was concerned about the sequence of events, and she was right to be. They do have an inpatient order, and the admission meets the 2-midnight rule, so they will be paid for the inpatient admission. But if that patient needed Part A SNF care, they would not have had 3 consecutive inpatient days. The patient spent 2 inpatient days at the first hospital, transferred, then had 1 outpatient day, and then 2 more inpatient days at the accepting hospital. The Part A benefit needs 3 consecutive inpatient days, even if it's at 2 hospitals. But here's the thing. I would have bet that nurse spoke to a physician who said that they approved the transfer. Well, that discussion really is a verbal admission order that could have been transcribed into the record and activated when the patient arrived. Then the 2 claims together would have had the necessary 3 or more consecutive inpatient days. Problem solved. So take a look at your process to ensure that you don't fall into this trap and have a patient stuck with a Part A, or excuse me, with a SNF claim. By the way, how are transfers paid? Well, that depends on the DRG and the geometric mean length of stay. The first hospital may receive a reduced payment, but the accepting hospital gets a full DRG. I often hear the term that DRGs are shared when there's transfers, and that's not correct. Chuck, back to you.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Hirsch. That was the Vice President of R1 RCM, Ronald Hirsch, MD. Dr. Hirsch was making his Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday. Here now with the Monitor Monday RAC report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Good morning, Nicole.
Hello, and happy RAC Monitor Monday. Today, we gather to delve into a critical aspect of legal landscape, the mid-2024 False Claims Act enforcement and litigation trends. The False Claims Act, or FCA, has long been a cornerstone in combating fraud against the government, and understanding its evolving dynamics is paramount for legal practitioners and providers alike. In my analysis, I've unearthed several key trends and developments that have unfolded from 2023 through the midpoint of 2024. Now, let's begin by addressing the remarkable surge in FCA recoveries witnessed in the fiscal year 2023, as reported by the U.S. Department of Justice. With settlements, judgments, and civil demands reaching unprecedented heights, totaling a staggering $2.68 billion, it's evident that the DOJ's focus on enforcement has never been more pronounced. Of particular significance is the shift toward DOJ-driven investigations, where recoveries from key TAM cases involving government intervention surpass those without government intervention. This underscores the agency's proactive stance in pursuing FCA violations, signaling a new era of accountability and vigilance. Healthcare fraud remains a central background, with over $1.8 billion recovered from the sector alone in fiscal year 2023. From pandemic-related schemes to allegations of Medicare Advantage inaccuracies and fraud related to the opioid epidemic, the DOJ's scrutiny shows no signs of abating. However, it's not just healthcare under the spotlight. Cybersecurity breaches have emerged as a top priority, with the DOJ ramping up investigations into alleged violations of cybersecurity requirements. This underscores the growing nexus between technology and fraud, highlighting the need for robust compliance measures in the digital age. One of the most intriguing developments revolves around the interpretation of causation in FCA cases, predicated on the anti-kickback statute, AKS, noncompliance. The ongoing circuit split on this issue was particularly highlighted by recent cases such as U.S. v. Teva Pharmaceuticals and U.S. v. Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. They underscore the complexity of establishing causation and its implications for future litigants. And Regeneron, for example, was just published March 28th of 2023. Furthermore, the Supreme Court's recent rulings on the FCA scienter component and the government's ability to dismiss FCA actions signal a shifting legal landscape, one where clarity and precedent play pivotal roles in shaping jurisprudence. Looking ahead, several key areas warrant close observation. The clarification on the AKS willingness standard, increased scrutiny on private equity firms, and the DOJ's continued emphasis on self-disclosure and cooperation factors are all poised to influence FCA enforcement in the coming months. The mid-2024 FCA enforcement litigation trends present a multifaceted landscape characterized by heightened enforcement, evolving legal interpretations, and emerging priorities. One interesting tidbit or quote from the Regeneron case: the then Inspector General for HHS testified before the Senate committee and testified that he said, "Our reports have shown time and time again that Medicare pays too much for drugs. Why does Medicare pay statutory requirement? Medicare's payment for a drug is equal to 95% of the drug's average wholesale price, or AWP. However, the AWPs, which Medicare uses, are not really wholesale prices. Some doctors began to refer to AWP as ain't what's paid. And that's just a friendly tidbit. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Nicole, very much. That was healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. Nicole is a partner in the law firm of Nelson Mullins. And coming up in about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer, Polana Houston, plus famed whistleblower Mary Inman. She's standing by to report our lead story. It is Monday. It is May 13th, and you're listening to a live edition of Monitor Monday. Stand by.
The American College of Physician Advisors is the only physician-led nonprofit national association of thought leaders representing all aspects of the physician advisor role. Developed to expand the influence of physician advisors through education and industry networking, the membership consists of physician advisors and other hospital leaders focused on a broad range of topics, including utilization management, case management, clinical documentation integrity, regulatory compliance, revenue cycle, and executive leadership. You're invited to partner with physician leaders and associated healthcare professionals to foster greater physician executive influence within healthcare systems. To learn more, click on the ad on the RAC Monitor homepage or go to acpadvisors.org to learn more.
Here now with the Monitor Monday Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glazer. David, as I say every Monday morning about the same time, what could be risky this morning?
Well, Chuck, it's the risk that you'll be too trusting. So one of my favorite things to do is to help clients extricate themselves from a False Claims Act investigation. I like it because it's intellectually challenging, and few things are more rewarding than keeping an organization from having to pay money. Now, frequent listeners know that False Claims Act investigations are filed under seal. The government then investigates to determine whether it wishes to intervene in the case. So during the investigative period, which is statutorily supposed to be 60 days, but in reality, think 2 or 3 years, sometimes 4 or 5, the case is under seal. The public won't and really can't learn about it. So whenever the government makes its intervention decision, whether that decision is to intervene, decline intervention, in which case the relator continue, kick the can down the road, or intervene to dismiss, the case is unsealed and becomes public. Now, I've been involved in something approaching 50 False Claims Act cases. For the first 2 decades, I would say you could be quite confident that the government would notify you of its intervention decision before the unsealing, so you wouldn't be surprised. But something has changed, and I don't think that that's still universally true. And this has important implications. The minute the government makes its intervention decision, the court file is publicly available. It's quite common for reporters, law firms, and others to watch court documents. If you haven't received a heads up from the government about their decision, you can find yourself in a situation where you're getting a cold call from a reporter about the case. And that is not exactly what happened to me last week, but it could have been, because I've got a case where we got the good news about the government's decision to decline, but we discovered it without hearing it directly from the government. Now, I realize this may sound like a practice tip for lawyers, and you may be thinking, I'm not a lawyer. Why is David wasting his segment on this? But this brings me to a second important point. There is nothing magical about being a lawyer. Non-lawyers can and do teach smart lawyers a lot. Good lawyers listen carefully to their clients, so you can help out your lawyer and yourself if you remind your counsel that they should set up a docket watch whenever they have a False Claims Act case. And if your lawyer bristles whenever you offer a suggestion or they act like you're invading their turf, think about getting a new lawyer. Now, the False Claims Act can be scary. The amount of dollars involved is potentially enormous. But my third and final point is that in about 3/4 of False Claims Act cases where I've been involved, the case resolves without any money changing hands. You know, there's discussion today from both Nicole and Mary about some significant False Claims Act settlements. But that shouldn't cause you to assume that the moment you get a civil investigative demand or a subpoena or a visit from government agents, it means that your organization will be writing a big check. If your counsel is thoughtful and creative, and you're willing to be patient, and the regulatory environment is as unclear as it often is, the case may one day simply go away. And I will note that in recent times, the resolution has often been just as silent as the unsealing was last week. You can't assume you will ever hear that the case has been closed. There's a very real possibility it will just go quietly into the night. So Chuck, Simon and Garfunkel may be right.
The words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls.
But there are times when the government's intervention decisions are
whispered in the sounds of silence.
Back to you.
Thanks, David, very much. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Fredrickson Byron in downtown Minneapolis. And up next, the Monitor Monday Legislative Update with Kalana Houston.
The Legislative Update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Kalana Houston. Good morning.
Good morning. Chuck, I'm going to touch on a number of healthcare news stories that we're seeing at the federal and state levels. Taking lessons learned from the COVID pandemic, the House Ways and Means Committee passed a two-year telehealth extension bill that will maintain current Medicare telehealth flexibilities from COVID-19. If the bill is not passed by Congress as a whole, current flexibilities expire at the end of this year. Proponents in the healthcare industry want the flexibilities to be permanent so that patient care isn't interrupted. However, lawmakers are reportedly concerned about costs. It is important to note that the bill did not address the prescription of controlled substances, which has been a priority for telehealth advocates. In other news, federal lawmakers introduced a bill to wipe out the $220 billion of medical debt in America. Led by Senator Bernie Sanders, the Medical Debt Cancellation Act would also eliminate medical debt from credit reports and limit the accrual of medical debt in the future. If enacted, this bill would result in four key outcomes. First, the bill would make it illegal to collect medical debt that was incurred prior to the bill's enactment and would create a private right of action for patients. Second, the bill would essentially wipe medical debt from credit reports by preventing the credit reporting agencies from reporting information that arose from medical expenses. Third, the bill would create a grant program to cancel medical debt and prioritize low resource providers and vulnerable populations. Fourth, the bill would update billing and collection requirements to limit the potential for future debt to be incurred. In other federal news, Senator Cassidy released a white paper on proposals to revamp the National Institute of Health, or the NIH, including recommendations on how to restore public trust in the agency following the concerns of COVID-19. The white paper, which is funded by the NIH, also touches on topics such as NIH funding and how to sustain the United States' competitive advantage in biomedical research. In other news, to combat the current nursing shortage, U.S. lawmakers reintroduced a bill to create a federal grant for an accelerated nursing degree programs for individuals who obtain a degree in a different industry. The bill was originally introduced back in 2022, but if passed, would create $10 million a year in grants to nursing schools to allow the schools to either add faculty, add clinical training sites, or to offer financial assistance to students. Many professional organizations have shown support for the grant program. In other news, the Senate Health Committee is planning to hold a hearing on dental care to examine the dental care crisis in America and discuss how to make dental care more affordable and more available. The hearing is this Thursday at 10 a.m. And in the state news, Alabama is opening a tuition-free public high school of healthcare sciences, specifically focused on training students for jobs in healthcare as a solution to the healthcare shortage within the state. Opening in 2026, the school was formally created in legislation and will be a residential program for students from all over the state. Back to you, Chuck.
Wow. Thanks, Kalana, very much. That was Kalana Houston, the Assistant General Counsel for Zealous.
This is for you, healthcare professional. Are you looking for the latest coding and compliance updates and insights? How about wanting to fulfill your CEU requirements? Look no further than the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Dive into the curated collection of resources crafted by industry leaders from our three top-rated publishers, MedLearn Publishing, Rack Monitor, and ICD-10 Monitor. From articles and webinars to interactive workshops and downloadable guides, discover a diverse range of content to fuel your continuous growth. For a single, low annual subscription, all your teams will have convenient one-stop access to the complete libraries of three trusted brands, MedLearn Publishing, ICD-10 Monitor, and Rack Monitor. One low monthly cost, unlimited access, and all the CEUs you need. It's the MedLearn Media Resource Center. Increase your knowledge with workable coding solutions and actionable answers so you can put the focus back on patient care with the MedLearn Media Resource Center.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, two recent healthcare whistleblower cases reached settlements of totaling nearly $10 million. Here now to report our lead story is famed whistleblower attorney Mary Hinman. Good morning, Mary. A lot of news to report there.
Good morning, Chuck. Yes, lots of news. Lots of news of the False Claims Act today. Over the past 2 weeks, we've seen two DOJ settlements and False Claims Act cases launched by whistleblowers that involve frauds arising out of the pandemic. Although it's been 4 years since the COVID pandemic started and PPP loans and contact tracing seem like a distant memory, there's often a lag between a particular fraud trend and the government's resolution of those matters as DOJ plays catch up in its usual game of pay and chase. Therefore, it's not surprising to see the recent spate of COVID-related False Claims Act settlements. Although both False Claims Act settlements stem from the COVID pandemic, they address very different fraud schemes. One, a case against a nursing home chain and its executives for misusing CMS's waiver during the pandemic of the requirement that a person must have had a hospital stay of at least 3 days, signaling an acute illness or injury, before reimbursing for skilled care in a nursing home. And the other, a case against a company providing COVID-19 contact tracing to the Pennsylvania Department of Health, paid for using CDC funds that allegedly failed to keep confidential and secure the personal health information of the contact tracing subjects. In their recent $7 million settlement with nursing home chain Renew Health Group and two of its corporate executives, DOJ and the California Attorney General's office resolved allegations first brought by a whistleblower that Renew had exploited a COVID-era waiver of the traditional CMS requirement that a person must stay at least 3 days in a hospital first before Medicare Part A will cover skilled care in a nursing home qualified as a SNP. With the waiver, a person with Medicare Part A who is in need of skilled care could move directly into the qualified nursing home and the home could get paid by Medicare for providing such care. The United States and the state of California allege that the defendants knowingly misused this waiver by routinely submitting claims for nursing home residents when they did not have COVID-19 or any other acute illness or injury, but merely had been near other people who had COVID-19. Renew and its executives adopted a policy that, based on the possibility that its long-term residents could get COVID, they needed skilled care, which consisted of frequent vital sign checks. Following this policy, defendants adopted a practice whereby one person, on the rationale that these residents needed skilled care based on exposure. Many of these Part A claims were false because they represented that the residents needed skilled care when they did not have COVID or any symptoms indicative of COVID or other acute illnesses and did not need skilled care based on having been near a COVID-positive person. Performing frequent vital sign checks on nursing home residents who did not have an acute illness or injuries did not rise to the level of skilled care. Next, as if more were needed, as a pointed reminder of the need to provide adequate cybersecurity for all personal health information and to have adequate cybersecurity policies, controls, and protocols in place, DOJ reached a $2.7 million settlement with staffing company Insight Global for its alleged failure to protect personal health information obtained during COVID contact tracing. The whistleblower's complaint included the following examples of the types of practices that constitute cybersecurity failures and needlessly expose personal health information. Certain personal health information or personally identifiable information of the contact tracing subjects was transmitted in the body of unencrypted emails. Staff used shared passwords to access such information, and such information was stored and transmitted using Google files that were not password protected and were potentially accessible to the public via internet links. This week, after a single hack at Extension Healthcare's hospitals exposed the public health, personal health information of 100 million Americans, the Biden administration announced it intends to require hospitals to meet minimum cybersecurity standards. These settlements form part of a wave of recent COVID-related enforcement actions and serve as a reminder that while it may feel like COVID is in the rearview mirror, the Department of Justice, fed by information from well-placed whistleblowers, is still hard at work enforcing the various permutations of COVID-19 frauds. That's it for me. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Mary, very much. David, we got a couple of minutes to answer some questions, so let's take a question, David, okay?
You bet. And if we could bring Philana in, because this is really a question from Ms. Houston. So, boy, your segment on, or your portion of your segment on the hospital and physician write-off generated a lot of questions. So would hospitals and doctors just need to write the debt off? Joe asks, hey, is this even constitutional? Is it a takings clause? Any comments you want to offer?
I could answer the first part quickly. As far as wiping out the debt, there is a great deal of medical debt that would instantly get wiped out if the bill was enacted. And then going forward, there's also language that addresses future billing and collections requirements, which will affect the future debt, the future medical bills.
I'm not a takings clause expert myself, so I wouldn't chime in on that one. But I think it'll be interesting to see. And I think we can say safely there will be litigation about it. Chuck, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, David, very much. And thank you, Philana, for answering that question. And folks, that is going to be a wrap for this, our live edition of Monitor Monday. And we thank you very much for being with us today. And a special thank you to our panelists, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, Dr. Ronald Hirsch, Philana Houston, and famed whistleblower attorney Mary Inman, who reported our lead story. And one more thing before we go, be sure to be with us tomorrow. That'll be Tuesday on Talk to You Tuesday. That's when we're going to learn about the good, the bad, and the ugly about Modifier 25. Until then, I'm Chuck Buck. Have a great week, everybody, and thanks for joining us today.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.